Welcome to the Canadian Cycling Magazine podcast. I'm Matthew Piaro, editor of the magazine and host of the pod. Those terrifying sounds you just heard were fat bike tires on the Wabash Trail. The Wabash Trail is the world's longest winter road. It runs between Pewaunuck, Ontario and Gillam, Manitoba. Sections of the trail are close to Hudson Bay. In March, Buck Miller, Eric Batty, and Ryan Atkins covered all 721 kilometers of the trail by fat bike. I spoke with all three riders shortly after their trip. Last year, they rode along James Bay, a trek they called the James Bay Descent. The Wabash Trail trip was longer and more remote, so I wanted to hear all about it. Their tale is not only a fascinating adventure story, it's a story that speaks to the challenges we are facing today. It's also about challenges, both environmental and societal, that we'll face in the near future. When Miller, Batty, and Atkins went into the woods, the world was one way. When they got out, it was completely different.
I mean, if you're naturally a worrier, you know, it's not something you want to be doing. You don't want to go to far northern Canada and test yourself in the, you know, the middle of Polar Bear Provincial Park, because it's real. Like, you're reminded how wild it is all the time.
That's Buck Miller. The Wabash Trail took him and the two others through Polar Bear Provincial Park. It's a 2,355,200 hectare area along James and Hudson Bays. Pewaunuck is along the park's southern border. And the park comes by its name honestly. It has polar bears. On the morning of the trip's second day, the team saw fresh polar bear tracks that were 800 meters from where they had camped the night before.
And you can't rely, you know, people say, well, is it really an expedition? Or, you know, you're on a winter road. You know, no one before us had done this. No one had ever been on a fat bike in this area. When you ride past polar bear tracks, you're just like, holy cow, this is serious. It's, but, you know, we all liked it. We didn't want to see a polar bear at camp. That's the only thing you don't want to do. If you're out, we were hoping to see one in the day. It would have been beautiful. Wonderful. Why not? Like, we have these, you know, beautiful machines underneath us, that human powered machines that we can take, you know. If we see a polar bear right now, we know we're going to ride 100 kilometers away. So it doesn't really matter. We were hoping to see one in the day. We just really didn't want to see one at camp. And luckily, the polar bear fence was not tripped.
The polar bear fence is a perimeter that the group would set up around their camp for the night. If a bear were to walk into the fence, it would set off a blank shotgun shell.
We also had a 12-gauge shotgun, just in case.
Yeah, I guess we kind of all had a role. In a way.
That's Ryan Atkins discussing the general group dynamics.
Eric's role was, I guess, the easiest to define. He was our, you know, our videographer, our photographer, and he did a great job with that, dealing with, you know, all the camera gear and the cold temperatures of managing those kinds of things. I think Buck was the logistics guy. He has the most experience living in the north and the most experience with interacting with the indigenous people and communities up there. So he knows a few keywords and he can kind of speak to the locals pretty well. And they were all wonderful. Everyone was super excited about what we were doing and how we were doing it. And they thought we were all just, you know, crazy white guys, but they were super psyched. And then I guess my role was kind of just like a domestique supporter, you know, cut the wind for the other two whenever possible. Had quite a bit of, you know, weight on my bike and just, you know, help with tasks, setting up camp. But really everyone was pitching in whenever possible, and it was a team effort.
Now listen to this clip on the trail. It will tell you even more about the group's dynamic.
So, were you guys pretty warm last night?
Yeah, it warmed up. I was hot.
Still went down about 20 minutes.
Yeah, well, when you have minus 40 bags.
And there's snow in the tent.
Yeah.
Insulating it.
And being used to minus 35, minus 20 feels not bad.
Yeah, it was good.
It's quite nice.
Is this day 6 or 7?
This is day 6.
7?
Today's Monday.
Tomorrow. 7. 6.
Today would be 7.
7. Stove's looking crooked, Ryan.
You look crooked.
In case you didn't hear Atkins's reply to Miller's comment about the stove, it was, "You're looking crooked." It's a silly yet deadpan retort that got me thinking about the role that humor plays on an expedition like this.
So the role of humor in a long, kind of isolated trip like this, I think, is really important because it's just like, it gives you something to talk about. It gives you something to focus on. I know that kind of I'm always thinking of like a quick response or a quip back at something that Buck will say to me or otherwise. And so I think it's really great for morale, and it's, you know, just a great way to kind of shoot the shit with your friends and yeah, just have fun out there, because ultimately, like, these trips are fun. They're
I know inside jokes grow and evolve and run through trips like these. I asked Eric Batty if he could remember any inside jokes a few weeks after the long ride.
Trying to think back, I think once you kind of remove yourself from the setting of being up there with two other guys for a week and a half, I think it's even hard to actually even remember some of the inside stuff that we were joking about. But I think kind of the gist of it is, you know, you're riding, you know, 8 to 10 hours a day, you're tired, you know, you're hungry, you're not eating enough, you're a little bit underslept, you know, the sleeps haven't been the best. I think you kind of get where, you know, the silliest stuff becomes funny, and you just start developing, you know, these inside jokes that kind of resonate through the group, and kind of, you just kind of build on them through the entire trip. And, you know, even nicknames and stuff like that. But I can't think of any inside jokes really off the top of my head that that you want me to repeat. I think that there's a couple I'm thinking of, but I don't think you want them on the podcast. But it builds, I think, you know, like you said, kind of like camaraderie, right, within the group. And, you know, there's a little bit of, you know, there's the odd time where there's a bit of frustration between, you know, one or the other. And I think in those times, it's really important to, you know, to remain as cool and calm as possible and come up with a solution. But there's also, you know, for the 1% of that, or less than 1% that there's, you know, any discrepancy or, you know, negative discussion, there's, you know, 99.5% that's usually positive and joking around and stuff, right? And of the three of us, I'm definitely the more serious in a setting like that, more serious person than Ryan and Buck. Ryan and Buck's personalities are definitely, they're pretty funny and they're humorous. And even though I find them funny and humorous, I don't always partake in their jokes. And when I do, they're kind of like, oh, where'd that come from?
There were a lot of crashes on my behalf. I was the only one, I don't know, if I'm not sure to use say the word smart enough or stupid enough to use the whole front rack system. I was a little bit nervous of the weight of the amount of gear we needed to have, and the lads were more confident, but you know, I had the front rack system, and it was really hard to steer with being fully loaded on the front with panniers. I had panniers on front and back. Like, the rack of the panniers alone are an extra 6 pounds, and that's before you fill them full of crap, right? So I was having a really hard time in the snowdrifts, and I would pretty well go down almost every snowdrift. The guys would just leave me. Their steering was just much more nimble than mine. And twice I broke something because the bikes are heavy, right? So when you drop a 100-pound bike at 30K an hour, or we weren't going 30, 100-pound bike at, 15K an hour even, onto, you know, super rough, half-frozen, kind of like, you know, so I broke a part of my pannier one day and I broke another part of my rack another day. And it's just like, it was, that was on day like four probably. And I was like, look, I, you know, can't really afford to crash. So we just, I just slow right down going through anything that was kind of really chundery and soft, and really, really rough, because crashing was clearly, you know, not good for the equipment.
We were just constantly joking about how, you know, Buck being a roadie and he can't, you know, stay up on his bike. And Eric and I were having no trouble kind of riding through all the sections. And yeah, something as simple as that would just like give us hours of entertainment.
Pedaling on the winter road was a mixed bag of, you know, it wasn't like you're in a race or anything crazy hard, but it was just, it's just relentless, right? And you can feel the weight of your bike, you know, into, and the size of it as well, and into the wind. And it was just, it was difficult, yet not overly hard. Like there was no time where it was, you know, it was like a mass sprint or something like that, or like a, you know, 60-minute TT. It was like a fairly light effort. And for the 8 days we were out there, the only day that we actually, you know, got to where we were kind of sweating was the last day, right? So we were keeping the riding as easy as possible. But it was that like just uncomfortable easy, right? So just you could feel that tension on the bike, right? And the bike's so heavy and the terrain is so undulating there over all the muskeg, right? It's you know, as soon as you go to go up one of those little, you know, 6 foot hills or something like that, or 7 or 8 foot high rollers, you know, you feel that 100-pound, 120-pound bike as soon as you go to go up it. So it was, and it was, you know, loose snow, right? A lot of loose snow, which was tough. And there was, you know, times where it was packed, and pretty quick.
Although Miller had some crashes and Batty's cameras seemed to need a few days to get used to the extreme cold, there were no major mechanical mishaps. But Atkins started having some serious trouble near the end of the trip.
Yeah, actually, my bottom bracket seized up quite badly on the last day with about 50 or 60 kilometers to go on the last day. I started noticing that it was harder and harder to pedal, and I got off to inspect it, and I grabbed the pedal with my hand and tried to, you know, pedal backwards to see what was going on, and I couldn't turn it with my hand. It had kind of seized so badly, and so it was at this point that we were kind of like, oh shoot, like what's going on, what are we gonna do type things. So at that point, there wasn't really much we could do. So we just kept riding, and it just kept getting more and more kind of resistance as we went. And the last 5 or 10 kilometers were pretty brutal. It was like, yeah, it was probably 200 plus watts just to overcome the resistance and then put in whatever I could to move the bike forward. So I was at the limit for the last hour trying to get to the end. But I mean, luckily the timing was good, and we held it together just to the end. I mean, if that had happened you know, on day two or something, I don't know what we would have done. Maybe we would have gone to a town and tried to get into a shop and pull it apart and put some lighter grease in, or I don't know. But I think basically the bearings themselves failed and broke and snapped and cracked, and the seals were all pooched. It was just carnage in there.
Miller, Batty, and Atkins started their expedition on March 10th. The next day, the World Health Organization announced that the COVID-19 outbreak was a pandemic. Then, the government of Ontario said students wouldn't go back to school for 2 weeks following the upcoming March break. On the day the group finished their trip, Ontario declared a state of emergency. Manitoba was 3 days away from making the same declaration. The phrase social distancing was suddenly everywhere. During the trio's trip, they barely knew any of this was going on.
We'd all known about coronavirus before we'd left. But it was just from the little bit that were in the news or in the tabloids kind of thing, or on social media. And so I was carrying an inReach satellite communicator, and my wife was sending us updates, mostly for weather, daily. But she'd also send a little bit of, just a bit of tidbit of information on what was happening with the coronavirus. So we were getting kind of very abbreviated messages, and trying to decipher that as best we could. So we knew something was happening. You know, and I was reading the messages to Buck and Ryan, and they were kind of, you know, that's impossible. It's never happened. You know, it's never happened in the last 100 years kind of thing. You know, your wife Eden is definitely overreacting and all this stuff. I'm like, well, I don't know. Like, she's not one to exaggerate, not one to tell me something that wouldn't need to be told, you know, unless she felt, you know, it was needed, right? So I definitely knew something was up and knew that she was probably playing it down a little bit. And so we had an idea what was going on, but we didn't really know.
When we went through the communities, not a single person mentioned it. You know, nobody mentioned it at all to us in any of the communities. And you know, we didn't meet many people on the winter roads driving vehicles because, like I said, in the 721K, we only passed 16 trucks. And none of them mentioned it either. But when we'd stop in the communities and say hi and you know, take selfies with people, no one mentioned it. It wasn't a thing. We stopped and talked to an RCMP officer in Shamattawa, and he didn't even send the message home. That's where I think in Shamattawa, which was 2 days from the end of the trip, is where I found out that the kids were out of school. But we still didn't know. That was it. I was like, oh, okay, my daughter's not in school. You know, I thought it was... I just didn't understand. None of us really understood the severity of it at all.
But then when we got to Gillam, we were supposed to do a talk at a school there, and we were supposed to meet with a bunch of people, and we were supposed to go to the community center, and basically everything was shut down. Everything was canceled. I went to the grocery store, and people were, you know, avoiding me and like walking on the other side of the aisle. And it just seemed like a very strange and different world than it had been when we had left Timmins, you know, about 9 days ago.
So it was, yeah, a huge surprise. I remember I met a cousin of mine who I've never met, or I never knew, never even knew she existed, in Gillam. She'd be my third cousin, so a little bit far away, but still my third cousin. And she didn't shake my hand. You know, I was like, what? Okay, crazy.
And then we had a 3-day drive home. So that was also really interesting because a lot of pretty much all the restaurants were closed along the way. So it was drive through the whole way, avoiding touching anything, avoiding doing anything. But we still had to, you know, travel to get home. And it was, I think, 3,400 or 3,600 kilometers of driving, or maybe even more.
Having the drive home was kind of an acclimatization to back to the reality of what was happening. But it was also the realization that, holy crap, this is actually happening, because we're driving home and, you know, gas stations are closed early, motels and hotels are closed, you know, restaurants aren't open, or some restaurants are only open for takeout, or so it kind of hit us in the face pretty hard when we were traveling home and we're like, holy, like, you know, what the heck's happening here, right? So, you know, and then obviously we, you know, we're doing a bunch of reading and stuff like that once we got cell service, and try to read up on it as best we could, and just to understand what was actually happening and what was going on. So, yeah, it was definitely an eye opener.
The Wabas Trail took the group through the indigenous communities of Piwanuk, Fort Severn, Shamattawa, and Gillam. The riders know the challenges that people in the north face, so they wanted to do more than just tour through the area. The group worked with a charity and had a fundraising element associated with the expedition. The goal was to raise $10,000 for True North Aid. They surpassed their goal by more than $2,000. Miller talks about True North Aid.
Yeah, True North Aid is kind of a it's a new not-for-profit charity that works within remote indigenous communities only. So far, they've done work in Ontario, Quebec, Nunavut, Northwest Territories. Manitoba is coming soon, and I basically chose True North Aid because I do not believe you can go to these communities and do what we're doing and not try and help and raise awareness to the plight of the troubles in the remote First Nations communities. It's a different way of life. You'll hear the argument often, well, you know, my ancestors left England when times got tough. Why don't they just leave? Your ancestors had a lot more opportunity to leave England. They could save money to leave England. There was initiative. There was incentive in Canada for people to leave England. Come over here. We'll give you land. No one's giving these people land to move to Timmins and to move to Winnipeg. No one's going to help these people when they leave, if they ever did leave these communities. They were born and raised in these communities. And if you ever get up to one of these towns, talk to the people. They love it. They love their community. They love living off the land. They love it. They don't want to relocate, and they shouldn't have to relocate at all. So True North Aid, they do amazing work. Anything from sports equipment, hockey equipment for a small community to, women's supplies, sanitary supplies, formula for babies and new mothers, all kinds of great work. And it's the most kind of grassroots, hands-on, direct way. It's the most direct charity I could find in Canada that works with Indigenous communities. And they've been wonderful to partner with. We've really enjoyed it.
While on the Wabash Trail, the team was mostly unaffected by the wider world. They had pretty much gotten away from it all. But a global issue had an effect on this trip even before the trio had started pedaling. Climate change was responsible for the trip's late-season start. The Wabash Trail winter road didn't open until the very end of February.
We did this trip for True North Aid, but we had we really considered doing it also for Protect Our Winters because, you know, winter without winter in the north, life is vastly different, and it's nothing like. You know, no offense to many of the listeners here, but you don't have winter where you live. 90% of Canada lives in cities, unless you're in Winnipeg, Montreal, Edmonton, Calgary. You know, you really don't experience a real winter. So if winter went away, life for you guys wouldn't change. And many would argue that life would be better. Not having, imagine commuting to work in Toronto with no snow to deal with ever. Like most people would really like that. In Winnipeg, most people would also be like, yeah, I could do with some warmer weather. In the north, no. I mean, like, you have to have winter. It's how you get meat. You can't afford to shop in the grocery stores. You need to hunt caribou. You need to hunt moose. You need to be able to get out on the land. And with winter provides an opportunity for hunters up there to access places that they otherwise can't because it's swamp. You don't get on a four-wheeler and leave Pewaunik or Fort Severn and go hunting like you do in Muskoka or in central northern Ontario. There's no four-wheelers are what you use to go to the grocery store. You don't use those to get out of town because you literally can't go anywhere. It's inaccessible. Your four-wheeler would sink a mile from town and you'd never recover it. So skidoos are a way of life that, like, you'll see people up there that they have very little. They own almost nothing. But they have a $15,000 skidoo, and they saved up for it because it's the one thing that can get them hunting and get them out on the land and get them to their spring camps where they hunt geese. Skidoos are a way of life, and without winter in the north, you're going to be on social assistance and you're going to have a hard time living. It's going to be tough. So, yeah, we noticed the effects of global warming big time, and. We talked about, knocking this ride out. We're like, should we do it hard and fast and go? But, thinking maybe someone would come behind us, if someone doesn't come behind us in the next 10 years to do this route, you might not be doing it. Cause it's a real narrow window. Pewaunik, opened, just on the last Saturday of February. And, the section from Pewaunik to Fort Severn. And all the guys we talked to on the road crew, maintenance crew, said the same thing. Like, we're having more and more machines bust through the ice. This road's getting harder and harder to maintain, and it's getting harder and harder to get supplies into the community. And to give you an idea, fuel gets hauled into Fort Severn, and fuel in Fort Severn is $4.19 a liter. So now imagine, you know, it costs $160 one way to go from Fort Severn to Pewaunik. You know, that's a lot of money for someone in those communities. So yeah, it's pretty wild. And, you know, man, the North is feeling the effects of global warming for sure.
I think the communities in the North, not just where we were, but, you know, any remote community in the territories and, you know, even other countries in the world where they have winter access only roads, they are firsthand feeling the effects of climate change. And with the winter road, that winter road supplies, all the fuel, which then, you know, is for the vehicles and stuff in those northern communities, but it's also for the diesel generators that power the town. Right. So they need those roads to stay open to get the trucks in with the fuel, and also, you know, non-perishables that will supply the grocery stores or the stores up there for the year, essentially. Right. And so when that winter road is delayed opening, that the communities, they're firsthand feeling it. Right. And it's, you know, you look at what we're dealing with now with the social distancing and whatnot. Imagine being in a community 700 kilometers from the nearest, you know, town that has anything more than just one store, and being delayed, let's say a month or whatever it is, right, to get out. And let's say, you bought a year's provisions, you know, to get you through with, you know, toilet paper and whatever else. If you all of a sudden, you're out, and you need to get out to get more supplies and you can't for another month, right? And I think, you know, even just with the social distancing and whatnot that's going on right now with the COVID-19, to me, it somewhat kind of resembles those northern communities and the effects they may be feeling on climate change with limited access or more delayed access to those communities.
About 2 weeks after Miller, Batty, and Atkins returned to their homes and settled into their new normal routines, I asked them each about one highlight that's still stuck in their minds from the Wabash Trail.
For me, I would say finding a woodland caribou antler was pretty neat for me. I was about 30 meters back behind the guys. They were just cruising, and I just saw this thing sticking out of the snow. And to me, the woodland caribou, you know, the polar bear is cool. I'm into animals. You know, I'm into the wilderness. I think it's all fun and like, you know, it's a lifelong passion of mine. But caribou, to me, are the absolute sign of wilderness. When you're in caribou country, not so much, I know, talking about the mountains, because the mountains are a totally different habitat, but when you're in caribou country in eastern North America, you know, you are in the middle of nowhere. It's proof that you're in the middle of nowhere. Caribou are a little bit like the canary in the coal mine. They are super sensitive to, they're not just sensitive to environmental changes, they're sensitive to human interaction. They specifically, anywhere humans are, caribou do not want to be. So they really, whereas polar bears, they'll come into communities. They'll be like, hey, what's up, humans? But caribou aren't like that. They're super scarce. And I just love traveling through caribou country and finding, I've been on a lot of northern canoe trips and I've always wanted to find a caribou antler. And I've never. So it was kind of hilarious to find one in the winter. And it was at the bottom of the winter road, a grader or a snow, one of the big heavy equipment machines must have dug it up at some point. It was still just four tips of it were sticking out of the snow, and I recognized it out of the corner of my eye, and I had to, you know, kind of bust it loose and shake it out. And for me, non-cycling wise, that was the highlight of the trip, because I've always wanted to find one of those. Now I've got this really cool, keepsake on my mantle here at the house.
The night that we got out to see the Northern Lights, probably the best I've ever seen them. And it was about 3:30 in the morning, and Buck had got up to take a pee, and he came back and was like, you know, the Northern Lights are putting on a little bit of a show there. And I'm like, okay, well, I've seen the Northern Lights many times, but all right, well, you know what, I kind of got to go pee too, so maybe I'll get up and go look at them. you know, and I walked out and I looked up and I was like, oh, we got to take some pictures. It was unbelievable. The sky was, you know, 80% engulfed in bright, 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 bright green and super dynamic too, like big waves. And it was just awesome. By far the best I've ever seen them. And, it was like 3 or 3:30 in the morning. And so by that time, Ryan was awake and I'm like, guys, we got to take some pictures here. And so, you know, it was almost minus 40 out that night, minus 38 or something. And so we're dressing up, just put enough warm clothes on that we can, you know, get out and go take some pictures with the bikes and whatnot. But that was pretty cool. Cause there was one particular moment there where I just stopped and I looked up and I wasn't taking a picture. And I just let it be quiet. It was dead silent. There was no breeze. There was no wind. They had already gone back inside. And I just looked up and just kind of said to myself, you know, this is a moment that I really want to remember because it's just beautiful. Right. And if I wasn't here right now, and if it wasn't 3:30 in the morning and Buck didn't have to pee, I wouldn't otherwise see this where we're at right now. So that was probably definitely the moment that I really, 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 really wanted to remember.
For me, one of the highlights was actually getting to see Hudson's Bay. It's kind of like this massive body of water that I remember first, you know, seeing on a map as a kid and thinking like, what is this giant blue hole in the middle of Canada? Like, what's up with that? And then, you know, fast forward 25 years and there I am, like, actually looking out into it. And I think it's that much sweeter when you've actually been riding your bike for, you know, 3 days to get there. It's like you've actually gotten to this place like under your own power, and it's just this massive white expanse that kind of goes on forever, filled with seals and polar bears, and like it's the place where, you know, Arctic adventurers kind of went through in order to try to find the Northwest Passage. It's just steeped in so much Canadian history. And when I got there, it was just kind of like one of those moments that kind of takes your breath away.
And that's the episode. It's put together by me, Matthew Piaro. It's produced by Adam Killick. He composed the music too. I had help from web editors Terry McCall and Lily Hansen-Gillis. Thanks to Ontario Creates for its support. And thank you for listening. Please rate and review the show. Ride safe, and I'll talk to you later.